Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. It's a podcast that's part of the New Books Network. On this episode, I'm talking to Dylan Mulvan about proxies, the cultural work of standing in. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
This is a fascinating book, and it's the kind of book that struck me as having both a really serious kind of theoretical contribution, but also it's a fascinating set of tales, really, of kind of stories about not just the contemporary world and some historical analysis, but actually with some implications for thinking about how the world is going to be in the future. And I suppose the place to start really is with this example that the book opens with of a proxy, which is also a kind of bizarre curiosity, as well as quite a sort of terrifying and quite worrying installation called Yodaville. And as a way of kind of like almost unraveling everything that's in the book, I wonder if you could tell me a bit about Yodaville and sort of how it introduces the ideas that the book is playing with.
Sure, I'd love to. So Yodaville is a city, we could call it, in the southwest of the desert of Arizona. It's about 30 miles or 35 miles from Yuma, if you're trying to locate it, in Arizona. It's about 6 miles from the U.S.-Mexico border, and it exists alongside a number of First Nations reservations and in the traditional occupied territory of the Kokopa and the Quechan. It is owned and operated by the U.S. military. Yodaville, it looks like a small town or city with 8 large radiating boulevards, but it's actually built out of shipping containers. And so if you look at it on Google Maps, it looks like the Arizona desert has a kind of asterisk in the middle of it, and that's Yodaville. So Yodaville was built in the mid-1990s, specifically as a response to what the U.S. military considered a disaster in the UN's intervention in the Somali Civil War. So if you've seen the film Black Hawk Down or read the book by Mark Bowden, right, that's a kind of signal failure of the late 20th century U.S. military's expansion into Africa in its so-called peacekeeping efforts. And the kinds of failures of in the Battle of Mogadishu led the U.S. military to look inwards at its training and how it kind of created simulations for training military personnel. And one of the things that they saw, and you can see this in the commissioned reports from the RAND Corporation, for instance, one of the things that they saw was that their training simulations for urban combat were overly reliant on representations of Northwestern Europe, right? Sort of Second World War imaginations of what an urban area would look like. And so they built this new area called Yodaville, along with some other encampments that were meant to reflect, in the really grim terminology of that Rand Corporation report, the quote, chaotic environments found in densely populated areas of the developing world. Right. So you can tell the kinds of flexible imaginaries that Yodaville was meant to stand in for. And so I talk about Yodaville as a stand in for any number of possible places in the U.S. military's imagining of its expanding empire, but also a definite place. Right. It is shipping containers in the southwest of Arizona's desert. Right. It is a shared training course. Right. It's almost like a textbook for pilots and military personnel. It is a common resource, a shared representation. And sure enough, when the U.S. military, when they did go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan, Yodaville quickly transformed. Right. It was no longer just anywhere in the developing world, any possible chaotic environment. The ways that it was similar to Iraq, say, were highlighted. And so you have military personnel saying, they got heat, we got heat. It is the ideal place to train. And I use this framework to talk about proxies, right? The people, the places like Arizona, the things that can come to stand in for other places as we train and standardize and produce knowledge of the world. So that's the role of Yodaville in the story of proxies.
Yeah, it's a great overview of both, you know, what a proxy is, and then this, as the book's title has, this idea of things standing in for, standing in place of. The book has got three case studies, and obviously we'll talk about the three case studies in turn, but I'm sort of interested before that, kind of what got you interested in writing about proxies and writing about both objects, places, individuals, digital images that do this kind of work of standing in, and how you came to kind of pick the three case studies that the book thinks through.
Yeah, absolutely. This project began, I guess, about 12 years ago with a research question that I got while I was in my PhD, of trying to figure out when something happened in visual media that my supervisor at the time had identified in audio media, and I was sort of the image guy. And so I located a moment in what we call perceptual techniques. Now I'll pause for a second. Perceptual techniques refers to when you design a technology to take into consideration how you imagine human perception works, right? So how much information do you need in an MP3 file for the music to sound good enough, right? Well, using a kind of understanding of the human ear, you can make decisions about how much information to include so that music sounds okay. I was trying to find a similar answer to the question about TV, right? When in television, did assumptions about human color vision get incorporated into the infrastructure? And this led me to the National Television System Committee of 1953 in the United States, which standardized color television for the first time. And in doing so, made all of these decisions about how humans see, how much green or blue or red you need in the signal for the image to make sense. The answer is, in fact, very little blue. And using that signal to compress the image, they were able to fit both black and white and color television on one signal. And this is kind of a really meaningful moment in the history of television, one of the things that let it kind of build and spread. Well, looking at those NTSC minutes, I found 27 color test images that Kodak Eastman had produced for NTSC in trying to determine how to build the color television standard. And these images are incredible. You can find them in work that I've done with Jonathan Stern, but they show this like very pastoral kind of idyllic life. Lots of images of people canoeing and sailing. There's an image of a woman leaning in a pile of hay holding a kitten that's just called Girl with Kitten. There are people playing table tennis, people drawing with crayons. There are curiously almost no representations of electricity in any of these images. And they were made specifically to imagine how color television would look, what it would portray, and what its kind of physical and cultural capacities should be. It maybe goes without saying, but I'll say it nonetheless, the images only show people with pale skin, they look almost nothing like the color television that would dominate American airwaves for the next 60 years. And I was fascinated by these images, like absolutely kind of taken by them in the way that they tried to wed both a kind of scientific goal, how to compress television in a way that incorporated knowledge of the eye, and this cultural goal. How do we envision television will look? You know, who will it portray? What will they be doing? There's also the paradox that these were still images that went on to standardize or were used to test and standardize the most pervasive image, moving image standard of the 20th century. From that, the rest is, in some sense, history. I started collecting every test image I could find that had been used to standardize the technology. And at one point, I thought the project would be exclusively about test images, right? There are these amazing images that were used to standardize the fax standard, right, for sending faxes. There's incredible images used for JPEG, for energy efficiency in LCD televisions. I have this corpus of different things I thought I would study. But very quickly, I knew that the story of images in standardization was one story that could be told, but that there was a larger cultural story about how we choose representations of the world for building institutions, right? And so I started to collect things like the standardized patients very early on in this project. And that's the focus of the fifth chapter of the book. And that's the use of medical actors in training and evaluating physicians. I started to look at other kind of test objects, what sometimes gets called in the history of science working objects, things like the use of chess in the standardization of AI, which many people have written about, including Nathan Ensminger. And I started to build this kind of catalog of things that I thought I might write about. Finally, it was these case studies that stood out because they, for me, could tell the story from the metric system, you know, arguably the most fundamental international standard that we have, to human performance in the case of test image models, and finally, performers at the very basis of medical education. And the story as such concentrates then on human bodies, human performances, and sort of relational dynamics within the standardization of knowledge.
I was going to say we can take the three in turn, but actually, because you've been talking about, I guess, you know, the sort of history of television and that sort of comment about yourself as the image guy, I wonder if we could start with the middle of the book and the is it the Lena or the Lena? I'm not sure the pronunciation. The Lena image, which combines a story about, as you've said, you know, standardization, history of the internet, history of television, of like, you know, pornography, kind of bad behavior in university campus and university labs, the sort of all dominant whiteness that you'd mentioned actually in terms of the history of what actually television broadcasts were like. What's the story of the Lena image, and then where does it fit into this kind of broader tale about proxies and the work of standing in?
Yeah, absolutely. So the pronunciations do differ. I think speaks to the kind of insider, but also mixed bag of awareness about the image. it is variously called the Lena image or the Lena image. And if you haven't looked it up, you can just search it right now. L-E-N-A is the most common spelling. And it shows a woman looking over her shoulder. She's wearing a hat. The hat has a large kind of feather thing tumbling off of it. You can tell that she's reflected in an oval mirror, and she's in sharp focus, but the background is out of focus. It has a very odd kind of aesthetic. It's kind of soft focus. Maybe there's some Vaseline on the lens. You might even think it's oddly cropped, since her shoulder is cut off in a very awkward way. There's a reason for this awkwardness. The Lena image was either torn or folded or cut from the centerfold image of the November 1972 issue of Playboy magazine by engineers at the Signal and Image Processing Institute, or SIPI, at the University of Southern California. The image was created to test the possibility of sending and analyzing images over a network. This is research happening on ARPANET, which is the predecessor to the internet. This is research also happening near the peak of the Vietnam War, in research funded by the U.S. military again. This is research that's fundamental to how we came to understand and build models for understanding digital images. The image first appears in published research from SIPI in about 1975. It was probably digitized in 1973, so says everyone who was there, which creates this interesting gap, right? There are different stories about how that image ended up on ARPANET. Some people like to say they were looking for a good image, and that Playboy was famous for its high quality images, that Hugh Hefner would only allow the use of the highest quality paper stock, right? And the image was glossy. Some people will confess to kind of desiring the image or wanting a kind of novel image, since images at the time were often recycled. Or there are a lot of pictures of the moon when you look at their research from this period, because they're also being funded by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and they're trying to figure out how to send pictures back from the moon in a more efficient way. So whatever you believe, there is another story that somebody was sent out to buy the magazine. That story doesn't make any sense, because they all agree that it was digitized about 9 or 10 months after the magazine was released. Between the 1970s and the 1990s, SIPI actually started producing image databases. So people would come to USC, and if they were interested in image engineering, they'd often be handed a tape drive. Right, not a cassette tape, but similar technology, and they could take that back to their home laboratory, and that tape drive would have test images on it, right? And we're talking about the very, very, very earliest days of digital image processing, right? What we now consider, you know, a part of our daily lives, right? This is people trying to figure out how can we send images over a network. And so those test images really are fundamental to the kinds of knowledge and knowledge claims that were being produced at the time. How could you compare what you were doing with a digital image if you weren't performing it on the same set of images? Right, so you might test your algorithm on a database of images, but at a certain point, you wanted to demonstrate your results on something other people would recognize. Over the next 15 or 16 years, that thing that people would recognize became the Lena image. Right, so when digital image processing gets its first flagship journal in the early 1990s, it splinters off from optical engineering, right? So people doing kind of analog or X-ray imaging or other forms of imaging. And in that first volume of the transactions of image processing, there are hundreds and hundreds of reproductions of the Lena image, which just shows how the image had kind of ascended as a shared test ground. So I trace this image and its ascent over those 20 years, right? How it lines up with the larger history of image technologies, work done by Lorna Roth and Genevieve Yu on images called Shirley cards, or in Yu's case, the so-called China girl images, which are used in film processing, work by Richard Dyer, right, on the ways that film technologies have been built on a kind of prototypical whiteness, but also on a kind of feminized and sexualized objectification, where women stand in as the object to be analyzed, and around which standards can be honed.
The critiques? So I was going to say the critiques are really important here, because one, you know, way of reading the story is almost the kind of like, you know, here is something that is highly problematic and tells us something about why we have the sort of, you know, sexist, racist infrastructure that we have around us. But also sort of slightly later on in the story, you're keen to highlight, actually, there's been lots of resistance to this and lots of critique. And, you know, it wasn't just a kind of a...
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccoli, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
A sort of unresisted or uncritiqued presentation. There was a lot of pushback over this.
That's exactly right. I mean, one of the points of the book is to, and by using such an ordinary word like proxy, instead of a kind of specialized term, is to kind of expand and highlight, you know, how these objects and places and people kind of float between being proxies for different things, right? And so in the history of image processing, engineers will often talk about how the Lena image is just, it's a great face, right? It's a great proxy for human faces. It's got flat but not untextured surfaces. It's got a reflection, right? You can use it to do edge detection, right? Detecting shapes, which is kind of basic to many AI techniques from that period. You can do facial recognition on it, right? So it's a great proxy for human faces. It's a kind of no-nonsense explanation for how it ended up the artifact that it is. But what I was trying to show as well is that it became a proxy for all sorts of other fights as well, right? So at a certain point, Playboy becomes aware that the image is being used in this way, and they send the cease and desist. And they, you know, Playboy was extremely good at enforcing its copyright. And eventually this is renegotiated, and engineers are given a kind of exception to Playboy's copyright to continue using the image on the basis that it was so crucial to the scientific work they were doing that they would basically have to unwire their way of understanding images and sharing results with each other, that it really was a lingua franca for them. At another point, the image is challenged in the mid-1990s at the heat of North American campus politics, right? The kind of what often gets called the political correctness wars, but it's really a moment of kind of feminist rebuttal against longstanding misogyny within STEM education. The image gets held up as an emblem of misogyny within computer science more broadly, right? So it becomes a proxy for a larger fight about gendering and sexuality, the pervasiveness of abuse, and the pervasiveness of pornography within engineering labs. And then in the last 5 or 6 years, so I started work on this image 12 years ago. In the last 5 or 6 years, the image has again kind of been held up as an emblem of everything that's wrong with computer science, and more broadly with things like data sets and their biases, the problems of representation that are hardwired in computer infrastructure. And there is a recent short documentary about the Lena image that is ostensibly that is funded by the Code Like a Girl campaign, which is an attempt to increase the number of women in STEM education, right? So it becomes, again, a proxy for a fight about gender and employment. And so, yes, it's there at all of these key moments over the last 50 years of computer science, where it can serve the role of a proxy for any number of different tasks, but also political, discursive debates about the use of images within computer science and image processing.
I mentioned that's the kind of the center of the book, and probably highlights all of the themes that run throughout the book, both kind of looking back earlier in the book in terms of discussions about standardization and kind of practices of making things standard. And then later on in the book, where you're talking about, again, things like race, racism, different sort of cultural practices. And the other two examples of how the kind of the metric system works, which is incredibly interesting. And then, as you'd mentioned, how medical education, medical training works. Draw on these themes, but I guess maybe a kind of slightly different in terms of being less to do with things like the digital and things like media. And I wonder actually, maybe you could give the two sort of contrasts, really, why you were writing about this thing that's like literally an object, which is like a kilogram. and so it's fascinating to even ask you about that, actually, because the idea of there being an actual kilogram, which is like the kilogram, and indeed there's not actually one of them, and they have to clean it and stuff, which is fascinating. How does that kind of contrast with, I suppose, the more sort of digital, more internet-based example of the image?
Yeah, I'm more than happy to talk about that. So the second chapter of the book is about the International Prototype Kilogram. It's only loosely about that and the IPK, if I can call it that, or Grand K, if you want to get really, really fancy about it. The IPK was, until a couple of years ago, the definition of mass. So if you looked at the actual metric system, you would find that it said mass is equivalent to the mass of the IPK, which is a piece of platinum iridium held under three glass bell jars in a vault in the suburbs of Paris in Sèvres, locked behind three sets of keys distributed to three different people. It is one of the most secure objects I know of. It's like a religious relic, but at another level. It is, or was, for most of the history of the metric system, the proxy for the idea of mass. It is a physical artifact that represents mass, and it has a bunch of witness kilograms, so it has some siblings that get called its témoins, but it also has a system of traceability that meant that every national laboratory had a kilogram that could be traced back to that kilogram, right? This kind of genealogy of kilograms. But there was a problem. There was always a fundamental problem with the IPK, which is it is a piece of metal, and metal is porous and leaky, and it picks up contamination from its surroundings, and they could never be totally certain how it had changed. And so what we get over the course of the 20th century was this desire, like absolute desire, to try to return the kilogram as close to its natural state, its original state, as possible. And you get these really beautiful protocols for washing and cleaning the kilogram by hand with an ether ethanol solution and chamois leather to give it a handsome but not specular appearance, a phrase that I will remember forever. And eventually, by the late 20th century, the metric system is actually rewritten. So right up until the redefinition of the IPK a few years ago, the definition of mass actually read, mass is equivalent to the mass of the international prototype kilogram, comma, after cleaning and washing. And this blew my mind when I was collecting examples of proxies and looking for the kinds of protocols and history and maintenance and repair that was required to maintain them. I mean, here was the definition of mass with manual labor built into every measurement we make, right? This idea that things need to be cleaned, they need to be kept up, they need to be washed by hand, and that there was an aesthetic dimension to it, right? That handsome but not specular appearance that is in the eye of the beholder. There is, as I've put it elsewhere, muscle and sinew in the metric system. And this to me is a kind of inescapable reality, right? That there's something aesthetic, something bodily, something muscular to how we live with information and data, right? If we can talk about an aesthetic dimension of the IPK, there is something probably inescapably aesthetic to how we think about information and data. And so part of the book is by beginning with the metric system or beginning with Yodeville, going to the metric system and then going straight into networked images and coming out and then talking about standardized patients, right? People embodying standards. There's an attempt to try to think alongside the network or the database, which I think are the two forms or structures that overwhelm how we think about technology in the contemporary moment, and trying to think alongside those structures about information and data in other ways, right? How is it animated by hands and people and models and out-of-work actors, right? In ways that aren't determined by the network form or determined by database knowledge. That's the idea of the structure of the book, why I begin there and end elsewhere, but kind of dwell in the middle on the network.
It's probably worth actually extending what you're saying about the connections between those starting and closing chapters and the kind of the embodiedness of the standard patient program is quite a nice link back to the strangely kind of, as you mentioned, you know, manual labor of cleaning the kilogram, which it sounds like a kind of like a Simpsons episode, doesn't it? You know, Homer steals the original kilogram from France or something like that. But yeah, what's going on with the standardized patient program? And particularly, actually, I suppose when you're thinking about the kilogram, you've got a variety of kind of critical theoretical interventions you make. But they're much, I think, starker when we're talking about the inbuilt assumptions about who is a human and who is not in the standardized patient program.
Mm-hmm. Sure. I mean, it's been a long time since I watched The Simpsons, but I think it's entirely possible there really is an international prototype kilogram episode at this point.
A terrible late era one where they've been
season 22.
Yeah,
Homer redefines mass. So coincidentally, the standardized patient program also began at the University of Southern California about a decade before the Lena image was digitized there. It was started mostly by one guy, a young med school professor named Howard Barrows, who had the idea that physicians needed better training in what we more or less call bedside manner, right? In how they show empathy and understanding for their patients. At that time, there had been a kind of bedside manner test, but some sociological research had said, had shown that, you know, chances of passing the test or doing well in the test were about as good as chance, right? So there wasn't a good system for training people in demonstrating care for their patients. And so Barrows had the idea of bringing actors into the classroom and having those actors perform, in some sense, wear the symptoms of illness and disability. So the first person he hired was hired out of the art department at USC, and she was a life model, a professional model. He brought her in and trained her in acting paralyzed, actually. We can talk later about why paralysis was important for that demonstration. Barrows was mocked quite a bit for this practice. It became part of the education at USC. It was tied to USC's proximity to Hollywood, right? It was treated as a kind of shallow exercise, right? So AP news articles from the time, you know, highlight how quote unquote lucky these med school physicians or trainee physicians are to be working with models, right? Again, sexualizing the labor of the people involved. But over the next 30 years, Barrows moved to Canada for a while and the program took off there. The standardized patient program actually became a necessary part of medical education. And now virtually anyone who wants to be a physician has to go through something that's called an objective structured clinical examination, or an OSCE, and prove that they can both diagnose an actor portraying the typical symptoms of illness or disability and demonstrate care, understanding, and things like proper hygiene in their acting, in their interactions with those patients. For me, the reason for ending the case studies with the standardized patients are, well, one, I think it's a fascinating story, right? I think it involves all sorts of things that we care about in media studies or in science and technology studies, right? Human performance as a relational instrument, right? The codification of the body. It involves the kind of masquerade of disability in ways that are, I think, deeply problematic, right? It shows how key performance, embodied labor, and theatricality are to medical standards and to the building of a crucial institution. And it also shows that if in some ways standards really took off, international standardization really took off in the 19th century, and the metric system is a kind of model of international standardization. Some people say the first metric conference was the first international scientific conference. We end with what I think is the outer limit of the possibility of standardization, which is, can you train people to act ill or disabled in a controllable enough manner that you're willing to base medical accreditation on their performance and other people's interactions with them, right? What an idea, right? To go from, can we agree on the size of a kilogram or a meter stick, right? Can we agree on these basic measurement units, to can we train people to inhabit an imagined idea of disability in a predictable fashion? And of course, it has happened, right? But I'm most fascinated by the work that it takes to actually maintain that system, right? So how do you make one person's body disappear so that you can encode another person's lifetime on top of it, right? So there's these scripts that people learn to inhabit particular bodies or particular performances at the same time that they also have to make their own body disappear, right? So you're told to drink water and have a snack so your stomach doesn't growl in the middle of an OSCE exam, because you wouldn't want your actual body to bust through. There's a whole schedule of fees that are related to how intimate of an examination you're willing to have, right? So you do, being an SB is not a particularly well-paid position. You can expect $15 to $20 if you're lucky. It's intermittent work. It's often meant for people trying to kind of piece together a living. But you can make more money if you're willing to provide expertise about the interior of your body. And so it, to me, covers everything I would want to talk about in the process of proxification, right? How do you transform a living person into a stand-in so that you can standardize knowledge, right? And what kinds of suspension of disbelief shared common practices, what kinds of performance are required for that process to be possible?
The three examples give a kind of framework that I can think of all different kinds of future research projects, future research case studies. But one of the things about writing a book, there's an element of kind of closure that you get. And I'm sort of keen to know, what do you do next, both in terms of kind of, you know, proxies and standing in as a research agenda, or in terms of just thinking about, you know, something completely different and an entirely different project?
Sure. It's a great question. I think, you know, as people tell you all the time, I'm sure, the hard part about publishing a book is that the moment that people want to talk about it is the moment that you're finally done with it. But I've had a lot of really interesting conversations about the idea of proxies and proxy labor, proxification, over the last 9 or 10 months, I guess. And I have continued to collect proxies. So if it started with some images from the NTSC standard and built to this kind of catalog of different artifacts and people and places, I'm still collecting those things. And I think one of the limits of the book is I've really focused on standardized proxies, things that have lasted a long time, that have taken on importance within institutions as shared representations, things that left a paper trail as well, that you could write chapters about, that you could cite things about, in some cases, cite other scholars about. So the things that I'm looking at now are things that are a little bit more ephemeral, things that don't vanish from view too easily. So charismatic proxies or failed proxies. I was fascinated in the autumn, for those of us who live in the UK, during the so-called supply crisis, which is when it was harder to find groceries on the shelves. There was this moment in Tesco and Sainsbury's and Boots where there were suddenly these cardboard cutouts of fruits and vegetables that were missing. I think it was so that if somebody took a picture of the empty shelves, it would sort of look like there was still asparagus on the shelf or something. In Boots, there were cardboard pyramids of fake sandwiches where the meal deal would normally be. I don't know that I can write a chapter about the Boots pyramids, but I do. It did highlight for me, you know, how important these kinds of stand-ins are for papering over gaps in a crumbling infrastructure. I do think, and I've said at my moments of being the most hyperbolic, that we live in the moment of the proxy, right? Which isn't to say there are more proxies than ever before, but that these kinds of relationships of delegation are front and center in the things that we care about. This is most obvious in the ways people talk about data sets and the politics of data, data doubles, and all of those things, which I think we could think about in terms of proxification, but also in kind of delegation to the gig economy, right? Gig workers as surrogate shoppers, or to the kind of Airbnb economy and the stand-in apartment, right? Or the shared workplace or even the stand-in dog walker that you can hire here in London. These things existed before, but not at the scale that they exist now. I'm fascinated by the synthesis of actor performance. So the use of computer technology to reanimate deceased actors. This is obvious in some recent Star Wars films, like the case of Carrie Fisher, or in the Fast and the Furious franchise, and the use of Paul Walker's brothers to stand in for him in that franchise and then overlay his face on their bodies. I mean, this is a really, to me, gut-wrenching example I would love to write about. Again, I don't know. That's a different book. But these are all things that don't fit the model of the standardized proxy, but things that have stuck out to me in the couple of years it's been since I submitted the final version of this manuscript.
I'm very keen on a Fast and Furious book, proxies book. I think that could be that could be the million seller.
Proxy and Proxiest.
Yes.
Yeah.
Very much so.